two, three. Fantastic.
Oh, awesome.
Hate it.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Music.
No. We have to do the intro.
We haven't done the beginning
part. We haven't done anything yet, Nestor.
I forgot.
Okay. Coming to you from the smoldering ruins of the Galvagoat, it's the Liberal Arts.
A podcast about life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
Everyone, I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Rissa.
And I'm Sebastian.
Hi, Sebastian. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Our friend Sebastian is joining us today to... Well, okay, so what happened was, is I followed Sebastian on Tumblr many years ago for Discworld content. And then we became friends through that. And then I realized that not only is he knowledgeable in many things, but that it would be fun to have her on a podcast and interview and talk about something that Sebastian is very into. So I was like, hey, do you have anything you want to talk about? And he handed me a list that was about 30 items long.
All of them super interesting.
It was hard to pick from.
I need to hear about every aspect of that.
Like, do not get me started, and that's a threat.
I'm here to get you started. Like, let's go.
Once upon a time, we did a year-long thing on the history of Turkey. So
I listened.
Yeah. This is, like, one time someone made the mistake of buying me a pint of cider and then asking me what my master's thesis was about, and that's what I want to do.
Oh, yeah. I've been there.
I mean, one of the things you said was just osteology, which is an entire science.
Yeah! Yeah, that's my thing. I'm an archaeologist and an anthropologist.
Fantastic.
Oh, so awesome. Cool. Dream jobs. Yeah. Dream jobs for this
Absolutely.
Podcast. Your most recent job was at a museum, right?
Yes, so it's for two years at a local folk museum, and it has an excess of artifacts, about 18,000 objects, which is a lot for a local museum. And I have far too many weird stories I could tell about that place, so I'm not going to do that today because then we'll go completely off topic.
But, well, I am very interested to hear what you are going to tell us about, but before we do that, Rissa, I believe you had, this is coming out the Wednesday after Christmas, but I believe you had a Yule fact.
Oh, not a Yule fact, actually. So last episode, I know I told a lot of stories about Odin, but this fact is actually about Christmas. So we're getting back into the tradition of telling fun facts at the beginning of our episodes. I'm assuming that all of you are at least vaguely familiar with Christmas, and specifically nativity productions. Especially like those, you know, those little statuettes. Right. Who all have you seen involved in nativity statuary?
Who we got? Jesus, Mary, Joseph.
Santa Claus. Three wise men.
Santa Claus. I'm sorry. Santa Claus?
What?
Excuse me? Try again.
No, I've seen them with Santa Claus on them.
Okay. So we got the big three. Who else is here?
Wise men, like Sebastian said.
Wise men?
Okay. The angel.
Wise men is where I want to stop. Right. What about the wise men? Describe.
They carry, what is it? Myrrh, gold, and incense.
Correct.
One of them is usually black if the nativity scene was made after the year 1980 or so.
Actually, pause. This is where I want to bring us. One of them is always black.
All right.
There are always three of them, and one of them is always black. This actually isn't a modern occurrence and has a very historical reason. So, in the Gospel of Luke, it just says that there were wise men. The word is magi. If we're going to believe that Luke is correct, which some people don't, these are actually probably priests from the Zoroastrian tradition in Persia. Probably all from Persia. We don't know how many there were, but way back in 500 AD, it was already established that there are three of them. correspond to the three gifts, which you already named. But even though probably the author meant to infer people from Persia, it is traditional that one of them is black and only one of them is white, and the other one is some vague production of brown.
Brownish.
And there is a good reason for this. It is actually nothing to do with modern, like, inclusion movements, and everything to do with medieval cartography.
All right.
Oh. All right. Yeah.
Have you ever seen a medieval Mappus Mundi, or map of the world?
Once. It was bad.
Yeah.
If it was made in Christendom, like the Hartford Mappus Mundi from England, the very middle of the map will be Israel.
Right.
That's what goes in the center of the map. And everything around it orbits Israel like an axis point. And we don't really care about how well we're portraying it as long as it fits in this general idea. Because the idea was the place that God came incarnate must be the center of the world because he wouldn't have picked anything else. And if you orbit your world this way, there are three major continents that make up the whole world. They are Europe, Africa, and Asia. And so, from the year 500 in Byzantine Empire, there was a tradition that each of these wise men, instead of all coming from the east, from Persia, actually came from, I want to say, Byzantium, Ethiopia, and India, specifically.
All right.
And so they were the kings of these three places. They were called kings, even, they're not called kings in the scripture, but they are called kings from very early because of the gifts they bring. And because it was seen to fulfill a certain Old Testament prophecy about kings worshipping this born child. If you ever see a set of wise men in which none of them are black, they've messed up. You've done it wrong. Because that tradition is as old as 500 AD.
All right.
I was going to say that also kind of represents some of the oldest established churches in Christendom as well.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. So the theory was that, and why this is actually celebrated, if you've ever heard of the 12 days of Christmas.
Right.
The 12 days of Christmas start on Christmas and go for 12 days, and then you have this thing called Twelfth Night on January 5th, and January 6th is the first day of Epiphany. And Epiphany is actually a celebration of the coming of the wise men, because this was seen as the first time that a Gentile bowed before Christ. And therefore, the three kings are seen as the first actual, like, pre-Pauline messengers to the Gentiles. And the idea was that they went out and started these churches that actually, like, responded to the gospel once they got it and all this stuff. But anyway, so there's a big tradition of celebrating these wise men, and there's a big tradition of them representing the three major parts of the world, Europe, Africa, and Asia.
That is a very fun fact.
You know. So yeah, I need you to look around at all the nativities around you, and just if there's one where they're all white, get rid of it. Do something.
Get a new one.
They should either all be Persian, or we should have a good mix of the three continents.
The one in my house is blue.
All right.
blue. I don't
it's
know.
It's made
what
of blue pottery.
That was the Atlantean king from the middle of the, you know, past the pillars of Heracles. We get it's the Atlantean.
Wait, no, wait. Back up, Sebastian. What did you say?
No, it's the Smurf nativity.
Yes, the Magi, the Smurf Magus has
the grumpy Smurf, the old Smurf,
you know.
And, I don't know, the lovelorn.
Smurf Magus.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the animals.
I'm just checking all of the nativity scenes that don't have a diverse collection of Magi will go over great with my grandma, who collects them.
Well, this has gotten into some controversy, because the tradition is so strong that one of the Magi should be black. It has led to the use of blackface in certain communities.
I've definitely seen, like, some images, again, out of, I think, Sweden from, like, the 60s that did this.
Yeah, so if you ever see that, that's what that tradition came from. And people have defended it, being like, we're not this, it's not a negative stereotype. It's not, and it's just like, well, maybe you should just find a black person and invite them into
the
team.
I mean, there's plenty of them in Sweden. I'm just
right?
Thinking you
too. Exactly. Yeah. So,
if your church doesn't have any black people, I think that's a you problem.
I feel like you're right. So anyway. That's all I had to share. I could talk about Yule if you wanted, but today I wanted to talk about Christmas.
Thank you so much.
That's cool. So yeah, if you're listening to this and it's not yet January 6th, Make yourself a nice cake and celebrate a holiday that has fallen into obscurity.
Well, we still celebrate parts of it over here.
Good, oh, yeah, because yeah. America hasn't much.
Yeah. No. Do you want to share a little bit about that? Because, okay, so Sebastian is in Iceland. Oh. We haven't said that yet.
Yeah, that is.
Oh, yeah, that kind of escaped us.
No, you know, just waiting around for the rest of the Yule lads to come trotting down from the mountains to, you know, bring gifts to all the children and possibly commit some cannibalism while they're at it.
General mischief, you know.
No, they don't do that anymore. Well, they do the mischief, but not to the extent that they used to, according to...
Somebody got some discipline in there, or...?
No, they just got a PR makeover probably, like, the 60s.
Good for them.
Slightly later. Yeah, but in the 1800s, they were a big incentive to basically get children to behave. Mm-hmm. So instead of having Santa Claus, we've got 12 Yule lads in the 12 days leading up to Christmas. And my favorite one is the one that eats candles, and he arrives on the 24th of December.
Also have the urge to eat candles on occasion.
Yeah, no, I mean, very good. Sense, because candles back in the day used to be made from tallow.
Yeah, and so beeswax.
Not even beeswax back then. Not in Iceland.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Just tallow. That makes sense. So they're very edible.
Yeah, and you know, if you were starving, like kids, probably were had makes the urge sense. Sometimes.
I'm trying to imagine how a tallow candle smells. I feel like
it is a very distinct smell. I was in a place where they were making tallow candles like last week, mm-hmm. and. It has an aroma, I can tell you that.
I can imagine.
That's amazing. Thank you so much. Would you like to tell us more in the form of your colloquium?
Yeah, today I'm going to be talking about my favorite historic sea captain, amateur detective, and notorious cross-dresser. Þuríður is her name, Formann Þuríður Einarsdóttir.
I'm already in love with her.
Yeah, she was absolutely incredible in so many ways. But I'm gonna give you like a little bit of a background for our setting, because I realized that 18th century Iceland may be something that most people are not immediately familiar with if they don't live here, and even if they do, they probably don't. let me set the scene a little bit. Þuríður, she was born in 1777, and what is 18th century Iceland like at this time? Well, first of all, the population is only about 50,000 people. There's no city to speak of. The capital, Reykjavík, will not be recognizable for another century. There's hardly any towns, hardly any villages. Most people live on subsistence farms in the, you know, all around the circumference of the country, because they need easy access to the ocean for fishing. Now, at this point in time, most people they live on small farms, but most land is owned by wealthy landowners, and they at this point in time they provide themselves with labor through a law that basically required every person who did not own land to serve a landowner in something that's best translated as like enforced servitude. Yes. Okay. And at this point, you know, I've heard this compared to like serfdom in Russia, but I don't know enough about that to like compare how similar they are. But a person enforced servitude was not paid any money. The most that they got was like free boarding and clothes from the farmer they served. And depending on how decent the farmer was, they could have kind of like an okay life. or they could be treated little better than like farm animals.
Yikes.
Yeah, it was a rough time. It was possible to, you know, through a few like loopholes to actually make money during enforced servitude and kind of escape it and have a better life, but it was very difficult. On top of that, this was during a period of Danish rule over Iceland, which lasted for several centuries, only ended in 1944. And this was during a complete trade monopoly, so we were only allowed to do business with Danish merchants.
Yikes.
Yes, and so this meant that they were able to keep the market prices really super high. At this point in time, child mortality was also the highest in all of Europe for a variety of reasons. So basically, bottom line, it was a tough time and place to grow up.
Late 1700s, was that a plague era?
I believe so, but I can't remember which one. but we're about to come on to something similar to that. So Þuríður is born to a farming family in Eyrarbakki.
Just a second. Yeah. Can you spell that both in Icelandic but also maybe anglicized?
Her name or?
Yeah.
Eyrarbakki. Do you mean like translate what it would mean or?
No, I mean like, okay, so I know that her name starts with, is it a thorn?
Oh, yes, a thorn. Þuríður, so thorn, you are. I with like a little dash and then an F and then a U and an R. But anglicized it would be Thuríður.
Thank you. That will help me when I'm writing the podcast description.
Yeah, I was going to say that'll help people Google it if they want to find pictures or something.
I can also send you my notes.
That'd be great, yeah.
My show notes. But yeah, she's born in Eyrarbakki, a small fishing village. She's lucky enough that her family like owns the land that they're farming. And her father, Einar, because in Iceland we use patronymics, so you know, there's no family names. He supplements the farm's income by fishing, like most people do. Then, natural disaster strikes, which tends to happen. You know, like every 5 to 10 years around here, we just off our last volcanic eruption and ended like a month ago. And that one was about 20 minutes drive from my hometown, so that was
fun. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, we had like constant earthquakes for like a year.
Oh my gosh.
You might also remember the 2010 Eyjafjallajökull eruption, which stopped air traffic in all of Europe. But the 1783 Lakagígar volcano eruption was way, way worse. It was similar to the 2010 eruption because it spewed a lot of ash all across Europe into the atmosphere, but it did so in much greater quantities to a degree that it effectively blocked out the sun for 2 years.
Oh.
Yeah, as far as Russia.
What?
What?
Yeah. Fun fact, the ensuing crop failure just all across Europe may have been a major drive behind the French Revolution.
Wow.
Yeah,
let them eat cake.
It was a huge deal. And locally, it also devastated the population because the volcano released poison gas. It killed as much as 75% of all livestock, which led to about 10,000 people dying of starvation.
Holy. Wow.
So like maybe 1 in 5 people died.
Yes.
Did the Danish government do anything about this?
Besides maybe take advantage?
Yes. Exactly. You got it right.
Oh no.
Yeah, they did not end the trade monopoly. They actually considered at this point in time, I think it was this time that they actually considered no longer keeping us as a colony because we were too expensive. And they were just gonna like kind of leave us to rot, which, you know, not the first time.
Fair.
But that is kind of the background all of this is happening to. So at this point, Þuríður is a kid. She's 8 years old when the eruption ends in 1785. life is tough. Fishing in the absence of agriculture and farming is more important than ever, even though there's reports of the toxic gas polluting the ocean to the degree that eating fish could actually make people sick. It's still a matter of, like, starvation. You have to fish, otherwise you're gonna die. Thurir is still, like, rather young to go out to sea, but her brother Bjarni, who's a couple years older, he's already going fishing with their dad's crew. But Thurir was, like, really keen to be a fisherman, so when she's 11, her dad agreed to let her join them as they row out to fish for haddock. Yeah, a few notes about fishing. At this point, the standard was to, like, fish on an open rowboat, usually with a crew of between 6 to 12 people. High fishing season is usually in winter when various fish species migrate past Iceland. The weather can get absolutely buck wild, and there's no such thing as properly waterproof clothing in this context.
Yikes.
There's oil skins, which in this case are just some sheepskin clothes that have been soaked in cod liver oil to make them partially waterproof. What? Yeah, the smell is horrendous. I have not drunk cod liver oil since I was like old enough to spit, but I can tell you that if you soak your clothes in it, it'll be that's your entire day. And the little, like, cherry on top for the whole experience is that at this point in time, the vast majority of sailors do not know how to swim.
What?
Of course. Yeah, I know.
Swimming as a practice for people to do is relatively recent.
Yes. And in this case, like, if you fall into the North Atlantic and you're wearing, like, heavy clothes, you're basically... Wait, I can't say... Yeah, you're basically not going to survive.
Even if you can swim.
Yes.
Oh, gosh.
No health and safety, no, like, nobody's going to get you, like, a little float to cost to you. So, you know, you might as well die. So keeping all of this in mind, here is an 11-year-old girl out on her first big fishing trip. She's wearing her brother's oilskins and her brother's mittens, and everything's, like, way too big for her. She's got a borrowed hand line. They didn't use nets. They would, like, pull the fish up one by one.
Oh, wow.
And hook. Yeah.
Wow.
And her dad is pretty skeptical about letting her on board in the first place.
Yeah.
But what does my girl do? Well, she throws her line overboard, and, like, as soon as it reaches the bottom, she feels a bite. So she... you know, struggles pulling in her catch, but her mittens are all too loose, they keep getting in the way, so she shoots them off and pulls at the line barehanded, you know, in the like, winter ocean cold, and
yikes.
By the way, this is no small fish. Haddock are usually about half a meter or, like, a foot long.
So larger than the small girl.
Oh, jeez.
No, not...
Like, you know, a significant portion of the small girl.
Sorry, I imagine all children to be minuscule and tiny, so...
No, that is entirely fair. To be fair, in this age of starvation, she probably would have been pretty small.
Yeah.
And she lands her first catch. And,
dang, okay!
Yeah.
I love her.
And then she throws the line back over and she feels another bite, and another, and then by the end of the fishing trip, she's caught more fish than anyone else on board.
Yes.
And...
I was so proud of her!
Me too, yeah. And then she has, like, thoroughly convinced her dad to take her on as a crew member, so she gets her own oilskins, her own mittens, her own line, and she consistently catches more than anyone else on the crew.
And her brother is pissed.
No, he's fine, because, like, if you have one person on the boat who is especially good at fishing, like, that is good for everybody, because you split it down equally.
That means we all get to eat today.
Yeah,
that's good. Fair enough.
So, noting that at the time, it was not at all unusual for women to be fishermen. In some areas, over a third of the fishing fleet was made up of women.
Oh, okay.
And according to the book I read, Women of Iceland by Margaret Wilson, this is pretty unique in, like, Western countries in general. And many of the fisherwomen, like many of the population in general, they were in enforced servitude, and as a result, they did not really get paid for their work. But being a good fisherman was one of the most valued traits a farmhand, whether they were male or female, could have at the time. And if you were not in enforced servitude, fishing was one of only three professions where a woman was guaranteed to be paid as much as a man.
What were the other two?
Haymaking and peat cutting, which were also very important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you're basically paid according to seniority rather than gender. With people, it's different between different sources, but either 18 or 20, younger than that, you would get paid a half share of the catch, and older than that, you would get paid a full share. So basically, you know, one part of what you caught. And this became especially important when Thuridur was 13, because then her father drowns at sea.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Yikes.
And her and her brother Bjarni have to provide for the rest of their family. So, you know, themselves and their mom and their little sister. And Thuridur became a fully fledged deckhand at 20, but she received a full share of the catch much younger due to how well she fished.
Yeah,
that's my girl. And she was recognized by those who fished with her as a very good fisherwoman and as a weather reader. She also had a reputation for wisdom and ability to settle arguments between the crew. And so it's not really surprising that she became foreman or captain at the young age of 26.
Dang!
Yeah, it was pretty young to be trusted with.
I feel like I've done nothing in my life. She's amazing.
At least you're not starving.
Fair. But that's mostly my parents doing, let's be honest.
But one thing that's very interesting to me is that at the time, it was actually very common for the county commissioner to basically split up families if one parent died. Or if they were too poor to support their family. This was supposedly a way to protect people from abject poverty, but more often that left them to exactly that fate. So children would be taken away from their families and fostered with strangers in exchange for farm labor. And then they had to pay back the debt of their boarding when they got older. And many of them ended up in enforced servitude as a result.
I'm good, so great. Upset by this.
Yeah, no, that this happened to my grandmother.
Oh
like,
my gosh!
That long ago that this happened.
Oh my
good lord.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's not been that long since we had a pretty rough time of it over here. but, you know, she got, my grandmother got very, very lucky. She got properly adopted. But, you know, the fact that Thuridur and Bjarni were able to earn enough in, you know, conjunction with their mother running the farm, that there was apparently never a threat of family being split up is very impressive to me.
That's good.
For like a couple of teenagers, basically, earning enough to support a whole farm. Oh, by the way, if you ever have any questions, you can just interrupt me.
You're doing a great job.
I have a question.
Yeah?
So you said up to a third of the fishing fleets were women in Iceland?
Yes. Depending on the area, but yes.
So I'm guessing, I know in some parts of the world that sometimes I read that there was this whole idea that women were bad luck on ships.
Yeah.
Feels very British now.
That was never the case here. Actually, in some places they were considered to be good luck, like in southwest Iceland. There were women's boats that were, you know, considered to be great for fishing for lumpfish, especially. And they were considered to be, like, extremely talented in that area. But, yeah, like I said, you know, I've already spoiled you for this, but like, Thuridur eventually becomes a foreman. This was also not too unusual at the time. But there is not a lot of records about these women because usually they had to do something extraordinary in some other area of their life for their story to be written down.
Like, it was to the point where it was ordinary enough that no one thought it was weird, so no one was like, we gotta write down these women's stories.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. Then later, according to Wilson, this is also like historical erasure, basically.
Oh.
When like new ideas about like masculinity and femininity came into the culture in like the 1890s.
Victorians!
Yeah, no, genuinely. You can blame this on them.
Victorians messed up everything.
They were so much bad.
Yeah, no, they yeah, not a good scene.
We're gonna have to have an episode on the Victorian hegemony.
Oh my
soon.
God! Do not get me started. regarding Theodore's ability to read the weather.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, so that was a very important skill in the days before, like, accurate meteorological equipment. Mm. People didn't really have anything to go from other than, like, what does the weather look like? What does the air pressure feel like? You know, what is my experience at sea? And people very quickly learned to follow her lead because she had a very good track record. One day, out at the fishing grounds, when the weather appeared to be perfectly fine, Formanthuria suddenly returned to the shore, and shortly after, a terrible storm blew up, and every other boat that had been fishing that day sank, and their crews were lost.
Yikes.
And after that, it became, like, received wisdom that if Formanthuria returned to the shore, even if the weather appeared to be perfectly fine, everybody else should follow her.
Wow.
Yeah. And at this time, fatalities at sea were, like, depressingly common.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Thurir already lost her father, and she would later go on to lose her brother at sea as well. And at the time, it wasn't uncommon to explicitly forbid families from fishing on the same boat because of how devastating it would be to the survival of the family if the boat sank.
Mm. Right, yeah.
But Thurir never drowned. She went on to fish for 40 years. Most of the time, she was a foreman. She started out on boats owned by other people, but ended up buying and captaining her own boat.
Nice.
She was also known for taking no crap. remember what I said about women and men being paid equally at sea? Mm-hmm. Well, one man she worked for, who owned the boat she was on when she was a foreman, he tried to get away with not paying her full share. And then when Thurir found out, she successfully sued him for her back pay, additional money in damages, and then demanded he pay additional money to the poor fund.
Wonderful.
And like, it says a lot about her abilities as foreman and also her character that even after she won the case against him, the man went on to hire her as foreman for 2 more years.
Wow.
So, like, yeah, it's just like, yeah, she got me good.
Fair's fair.
Yeah, yeah.
Guess I can't deny that.
It's the fair cop gov. Yeah, now, it did say that Thurir was a notorious crossdresser in her day. And of course, I won't leave you hanging on that subject. So at the time, it wasn't unheard of for women to wear trousers at sea, although most of them would wear like 2 sets of wool skirts, which, by the way, made them way more heavy when waterlogged, mm-hmm. and meant that they were at a greater risk for drowning, which was a good enough reason all by itself to want to wear pants. But Thurir didn't just wear trousers at sea; she wore them all the time, and it became known as like her signature outfits, like men's trousers. She would wear like a rust-colored gentleman's jacket and a top hat, and she would carry a horse whip.
Oh my gosh!
Amazing. Yeah. Okay, yeah. I was in love with her before. I'm extremely in love with her now.
Yeah, like, you know, I get so upset that she died 150 years ago, because every time I read, I'm just like, oh, is she single?
For real.
But this was very unusual at the time, and yeah, it seems to have been accepted as just something that she did.
Good for her.
It probably helped that she had like the respect of her community, but I cannot imagine, like, she probably had to have like a very strong will to be able to keep this up, because at the time a woman wanted to wear trousers in public, she actually had to apply for and pay for a permit from the Danish colonial government.
What?
Yeah.
There is, wow.
Yeah.
The fact that they went to the trouble to make that a formal,
mm-hmm.
wow.
I wonder about that, because like, What was the legal precedent that they were like, well, we just gotta have this in just in case.
Like, we have pink tax now, but that was like an actual tax.
Right, yes.
The tax on pants wearing.
Exactly.
How do you... Wow. I want to know the process for enforcing this law.
I want to know if... Yeah, that's fair.
They'd probably arrest you if they saw you wearing trousers.
I want to know if there was anybody ever whose job it was to help other women fill out the paperwork to wear pants. Like, I'm the pants lawyer. Come to me if you want to wear pants.
Do you have to carry a card? Excuse me, show me your pants papers.
This paper just says I can do whatever I want.
So, considering the kind of small local communities that we're talking about, it was probably a case of, like, the sheriff knows everybody he is ever likely to meet, and so he knows who has what paperwork, but I'm not actually certain. And the thing is, like, they would enforce this law. I remember at least one case, although I can't remember precisely when it happened, I think it was somewhere in the 1700s, where a woman who was a vagrant was arrested and whipped, I think, 50 times for wearing men's clothes. Yeah, and for not having a permit. And the thing is, Thutis didn't have a permit. She just did as she liked.
Wonderful.
And apparently it didn't become an issue, actually, until the robbery case that she was involved in solving, which we will circle back around to later.
Oh boy, there's more?
There's more. Actually, a little bit, I would actually... want to do a little bit of a diversion about her personal life, because Thurid had three like close relationships that we know of. The first was with a guy called Jón Ólafsson, and she moved in with this guy for 15 weeks when she was 26, and then she moved out again, but they never got married. And second relationship, she moved in with a guy called Erlendur Þorvaldsson. Her mom actually moved in with them as well. And
one big happy family.
Yeah. And then again, she didn't get married to him, even though they had a child together.
Oh my gosh.
Like, wow. they had a girl called Thordís, who actually, tragically enough, she died aged 3. But then, like, she split up with him and apparently, you know, remained on, like, good terms with this guy. But...
this woman was just not here for the paperwork.
I know, right? She just is like, I refuse to live on the grid.
Exactly.
Miss me with those permits.
But yeah, like, I mean, at this point in time, it was actually pretty difficult to get married, at least if you were in enforced servitude. Oh. Because then if you were, you legally could not get married.
Right.
But, I mean, in this case, Thuridir, that was not a problem for her. Like, she was not in enforced servitude. She had access to her family farm. The lad she had relationship with also owned land. So they very well could have gotten married. But apparently Thuridir just refused to, saying that she wanted to see if the relationships worked out before she committed to them.
See? Wise woman.
Yeah.
All right.
But make no mistake, having a child out of wedlock was not at all encouraged in the early 1800s.
Yeah,
I'm honestly amazed that she was able to remain unmarried with a young daughter, even, you know, that didn't last, and still not be, like, ostracized from her community. I was not able to find any more detail on that, but that just kind of bewilders me.
Yeah, so interesting.
I know, right?
They knew they would all starve without her.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can get away with when you're one of those essential workers.
When you control when all of the ships come home.
Her third relationship is a lot different and a lot weirder. So when she was 43, one of her deckhands, another guy called Jón, everybody in the story is called Jón, he proposed marriage to her. Now, Thurir wasn't interested, and Jón was 22 years younger, so she said no.
Oh gosh.
But then he declared that he would stop working for her if she didn't marry him. And since apparently she didn't want to lose his employment, she ended up agreeing?
What?
The nerve of this man!
Yeah, I know! they were married on October 31st, 1820, And their marriage did not last for
Jeez, shocking. With that kind of a start?
Yeah, she was like clearly unimpressed with being coerced into marriage and reportedly refused to have sex with him.
Good for her.
Good for her.
So really, was it ever a marriage to begin with?
Not really. Like, she divorced him after 2 years, but despite everything, the divorce was actually mutually agreed upon, and neither of them made any, like, financial claims on the other.
Did he ever quit working for her?
Apparently, I think that...
I need to know if she worked with her ex.
I mean, she did work with... One of the other guys she got together with was, like, on her boat for, like, a while, fair. So... Yeah, you know.
All right. Amicable. I like it.
Yeah.
How good at fishing were these people that they could just walk around in pants and force people to marry them?
Yeah. I genuinely wonder about this guy, like, because he was also, he was like a farm worker on her farm. And I don't know, maybe 10,000 people die? Maybe the labor shortage is just that severe? I genuinely don't know.
This is another reason why we have to slow the spread of COVID.
So we don't get forced marriage proposals on fishing vessels?
Yes.
Change, the more they stay the same.
Ain't
that
the truth?
Okay. Okay, so now with all that out of the way, I'll finally move on to the robbery that
yes.
theory that she ended up solving. So we already established that she was a very much a larger than life figure, but this is basically the event that led to her story being written down by author Brynjólfur Jónsson, and it was published in a serialized magazine between 1893 and 1897. This robbery was the second most high-profile criminal case in Iceland in 1827 when it occurred. Only, you know, the second, because the first one was like a gruesome double homicide.
Oh, fun!
Yes. You know, which actually we could do a whole episode about that, but I'm not gonna get into that. So they in the middle of the night on February 9th. Four masked men stormed into the Kambur farm, not far from Stock City Village, where Thuridur lived. They attacked and tied up the four people who were at home, sleeping in their beds. So the farmer, his wife, a woman farmhand, and a nine-year-old boy. They trashed the place, they threatened the people, they forced the farmhand to tell them essentially where the farmer, who was like a big landowner guy, where he hid his money. And, you know, fearing for her life, she relented, and the four men dug up the money, which was hidden in the floor of the sheep barn. Then they disappeared, leaving the four of them still tied up. They eventually got loose, and they got help from their neighbors, but they were unsuccessful in following the robbers. Now, their first suspicion was that these men were actually lived down by the sea. This was actually quite a ways away from the sea, because their clothes smelled of basically burnt seaweed, which is what people used to heat their houses by the shore.
Huh.
Yeah. So that's kind of what got them on the right track. After this was reported to the district commissioner, he set out to solve the case because the robbers had taken nearly 1,000 Danish dollars, which I did some calculations, but it's very hard to convert old-timey currency into modern stuff. But my best guess that this would be about 2.6 million Icelandic krona, or about $19,300. Or about 17,000 euros.
That's almost as much as my debt.
Yeah. The actual like worth of the money would actually probably be a lot more, because this was in a time where most people didn't have any money at all.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
they, mm-hmm. if they were doing business, they would usually be like exchanging, you know, wares. Nobody was really carrying that amount of cash around. So, following up on the seaweed lead, the district commissioner and his assistant went to Stokseter village to investigate, and while asking around for potential witnesses, one man directed them to Formanthyrður, saying that she was noted for her powers of observation, and that if anyone had noticed anything out of the ordinary, it would be her.
Listen, Commissioner, you gotta go talk to the smartest person you know. She's so smart.
She's so cool. Like, she punched me in the face once, and it was And basically, the district commissioner immediately sent his assistant to go get her. Now, Thurir was busy, like, waterproofing her boat, and she was wearing work clothes, aka trousers. So, like, she asked the assistant to wait for her to change before she appeared before the commissioner, aka a cop.
Yeah.
But the assistant refused and ordered her to come immediately, so she relented. Now, I know, right? So Fyrir is 50 years old at this point. She's been dressing in men's clothes all of her adult life. So when she appeared in front of the commissioner, like, she was perfectly aware that what she was doing was illegal without a permit. And she basically told him she wouldn't have appeared before him dressed like that if the assistant hadn't, you know, rushed her. But the commissioner replied that, quote, he knew perfectly well, just like everyone else, that this was how she liked to dress every day. However, because it was technically illegal and she did not have a permission letter, he would provide one for her on the condition that she help him figure out who was behind the robbery.
Oh my god!
Oh wow.
I know.
This is... you couldn't write this for a novel.
That's right. You have very weird forms of blackmail in Iceland.
I know!
I feel like maybe this trade economy just gets you kind of a tit-for-tat thing going around.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, it was a... Yeah, it's one of those things that makes me think that, like, I'm not trying hard enough as an author. I really should be doing weirder stuff. Yeah, you know, let me have your crime-solving acumen in exchange for your cross-dressing.
Permission to wear pants.
Yeah.
Payment and permission to wear pants. That's the title of this episode.
Permission to wear pants.
Yeah. Actually, I think the title of this episode will be I'm the Pants Lawyer.
Absolutely. Now, this was apparently worthwhile enough to Thurðish that she asked to see the evidence found at the scene. And there was, like, a weird amount of evidence that they found. They found, like, you know, basically some rags left behind, like a poker, somebody's shoe, a hat. It was almost like they had, the robbers had just been shedding evidence as they went. Almost to, like, you know, this would be a Nancy Drew game, basically. you know, you have to put all the pieces together. And she particularly noted a shoe that was found at the scene at, like, the edge of the farm, presumed to have been dropped there by one of the robbers, or lost, rather. I don't think they were just carrying a shoe around.
These are my extra shoes. Ah, dunk, I missed one.
This is my shoe friend, Wilson. Now, at this point in time, most people wore shoes made out of fish leather because cow leather was very expensive.
I didn't even know you could make leather out of fish!
Yeah. It's a fashion thing in Iceland now, but back in the day, it used to be, like, standard for shoe wear. Shark skin,
so
as well, would be made into shoes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That makes more sense to me.
I heard that there are some pairs of shoes that people would measure distances in how many pairs of shoes you would need to cross
true.
The distance. Because the shoes would wear down so quickly that you could measure a distance.
That's how they used to measure distances in Iceland. I used to tell people to when I was doing tours at the museum, like, you know, people didn't measure distances in miles or kilometers. It would be like, you know, you have to walk 8 days distance, so it's about 7 pairs of shoes.
Jeez.
Yeah, they were basically disposable, depending on what kind of fish leather you had lying around. A lot of people wore shoes exactly like the ones they showed her. However, she recognized the craftsmanship as belonging to an expert. Ooh. She could confidently narrow it down to 3 different farms where the maker would employ that same technique. And she could further narrow it down to 1 based on alibis and opportunities of people involved.
Wow.
The man she suspected was a guy called Sigurdur Gottsveinsson, who had rowed for Fyrir for 1 season at sea. And he was very strong and he was quite good at fishing, but she refused to hire him back because he had a really bad temper.
Oh.
And later she was able to identify another man, a blacksmith called Jon Girmundsson, who I'm going to call by his last name because there are going to be so many Jons in the story in a second. And the metal poker that they found at the scene that was used as a weapon, basically. She, while visiting this guy, basically was able to identify that there was a notch in his anvil, which would have left a mark on everything that he hammered on said anvil. And so she was able to identify that this poker had been made on his anvil.
Something
that 2 other blacksmiths that had already been consulted by the commissioner had not been able to spot.
My gosh. She's a genius.
Yeah, she's she's like the Sherlock Holmes of this scene. I have no idea where she gets it from. She's just very intelligent.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I love her.
She's incredible.
Is it wrong that I'm still impressed that they got even that far on 18th century forensics?
No, absolutely. I'm amazed because, you know, most of the time when you read about historical, cases like these, it's literally the thing of being well, I bet it was this guy because we don't like him.
He seems suspicious.
You know, he is an outsider in the community and possibly a foreigner. You know, that seems to be the extent of people's deductive reasoning.
Yeah. A lot of time it ends up being, it must have been so-and-so's fault because no one will defend them.
Yeah, yeah, basically, mm-hmm. that was what happened with the witch burnings in 700 Iceland, for instance.
Oh, y'all had those too, huh?
Oh yeah, but we had them way later than everybody else, and it was actually mostly men and not women.
Interesting. Whoa.
Yeah, there's a historical reason for that, but I won't get started on exactly why because.
Dang it! You keep tantalizing us with these tidbits.
Welcome to our newly established series, Sebastian's Explains Everything.
Yeah, the rest of this podcast is just going to be a series of us asking you back on the podcast to say more.
Hey, I'm down. I'm down.
Yay!
let me see, where was I? Oh, so the thing is, Fyrir knew Girmundsson quite well. And his whole family, and after he was arrested, he made her promise to look out for his daughter. Thuridish accepted. And the third man, another Jón, Kolbeinsson, he was crew on Thuridish's boat. He actually came and asked to be on her crew shortly after the robbery happened. And the comment that he made in her presence, basically they're suspecting everybody around here. It's only a matter of time before they get to me.
Oh my gosh.
Made her suspect that he had a part in the robbery.
Wow.
Now, this guy ended up shooting himself in the foot because he picked up on her suspicion and he just started following her around everywhere she went.
My God.
And, you know, not letting her talk to people without him being in her presence, which made it difficult for her to, air out her suspicion of him.
Wow. It's like he's trying so hard to be a mastermind and just failing.
Exactly.
Just played yourself.
Yeah, and of course, she became more suspicious as a result.
Mm-hmm.
And when a piece of evidence in the case, a mitten, basically, disappeared, and Kolbeinsson was known to have been in the vicinity when that happened, she went and took her suspicions to the commissioner. Now, he wasn't entirely convinced, although Theodore had already brought in two of the four robbers, but he relented when she said that she feared Colbinson might actually try to kill her due to her part in the investigation, and due to the way he was, like, constantly following her around.
Yikes.
Yeah, it has to be, like, pretty creepy for, yeah, you know, something for your employer to do. And after he was arrested, the other Jón, Germundsson, who had been in custody for over a month, but had not admitted to his crimes yet, finally spilled the beans and identified the last member of the party, who was Kolbensson's brother, Hafliði, who was also crew on Thurir's boat.
Oh my god!
So he was, like, in the perfect position to pick out all of these guys, basically.
Wow.
And I find it worth noting that when the commissioner came to arrest Hafliði, they had just returned to shore after, like, their second, you know, turn around the bay catching fish. Thurir demanded that he not be taken away until he was allowed to eat, because fishermen never ate while out at sea, and this would have been, like, his first meal of the day.
Oh, yeah.
And which, you know, is just another test to her character. And apparently, you know, this weighed on her because she actually really liked the brothers, not just as workers, but, like, as people. They were known to be very decent guys.
Hmm. Hard to get mixed up in all this.
I know.
To one named Jón.
Exactly. But while there, the commissioner informed her that Germundsson, the first Jón, basically refused to see anyone and was starving himself in the hope that he would be dead before he was imprisoned. Because prison in those days was nothing to, you know, celebrate.
Yeah.
So Thurir went to see him and convinced him that his family would be better off if he lived, and essentially made a deal with the commissioner that the commissioner would take care of this guy's family if he went to jail, if he was, like, cooperative with the law. And, you know, because this guy kept, like, carrying on and saying that he was better off dead and everything, she eventually threatened that if he died of starvation, she would have nothing to do with his daughter, but that if he lived, she would do as she had promised and look out for her until, like, the end of her days.
Wow.
Yeah, she was just, like, a very... She was just a personality, this lady, you know.
She was the powerful pants lawyer.
Yeah. So he basically accepted her terms and agreed to live. The trial over these four guys, it lasted over 6 months, and over 30 people were called in for questioning.
Whoa.
But no one had as big an impact on the case as Thurir did.
Of course.
Now, this was in the time of corporal... Is it corporal or corporeal?
It's corporal.
Corporal punishment.
Yeah, corporeal means having a physical body.
We're going to punish you by giving you a physical form.
Ain't that so?
Ain't that just the way? But yeah, so, you know, basically none of the robbers got off easy. Sigurdur, as the leader of the group, was condemned to serve slave labor for the rest of his life in a Danish prison, and to be branded and to be whipped.
Good Oof. Lord.
I know, right? He was executed in prison for assaulting a guard, and some sources indicate that he may have done it as like a method of suicide. Like,
oh yeah,
because he was going to be stuck in this prison until he died anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And Germundsson received a whipping and was also sentenced to a lifetime of slave labor. The two Kolbensson brothers got 12 and 8 years of slave labor, respectively, but were apparently able to appeal and returned home, I think, after 8 years. But in addition, their farms and their property were seized and used to pay back the money they stole, along with legal costs surrounding the case. Now, according to some sources, Thurir took this pretty hard. Some sources say that she started drinking pretty heavily, but not all of them agree on this point. However, if this was like, you know, a noir detective show, this would be like her backstory, like, oh, why does the PI drink so much? Well, because you sent good men to jail.
You ever heard of the Coppins and Brothers?
In this adaptation, she's played by Humphrey Bogart. Yes. Nothing about her character. Oh my god, no. She was played by Ilsa Lind, but she's dressed like Humphrey Bogart. Yeah.
Nice. The whole time you've been telling this story, I've been like, I want a movie, but now I want 5 movies, all in different genres.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I am honestly astonished that there is not, like, I mean, okay, the Icelandic film industry is not huge, but I am amazed that there is not a movie about her.
Yeah.
I was going to say, is Thurider a well-known person in Icelandic history?
She is. Like, she is probably the best well-known, not just the female sea captain, but just, like, of all of the foremans in general from this time period. There is a reconstruction of her house in the village where she lived.
Wow. Yeah. I want to go to that desperately.
It is very small. It's a turf house, like most houses from that period. And yeah, I honestly can see probably wouldn't have been that bad to live there. But she apparently kept her promise to Geirmundsson regarding his daughter. Now, Thurður died in 1863, aged 86 years old, having been a foreman for 40 years.
Dang.
And I mean, you know, I probably could tell you a bunch of other stories about her, but this is like the most salient part. Although I would like to add the anecdote I sent to you, Hannah, where when she was in her 70s, she went to the sheep roundup in her county. Where she ran across basically an old neighbor who, because she was dressed in her you know, normal clothes of like pants and a jacket and the top hat and everything, he apparently asked her if she was quote unquote doubly endowed because she was wearing men's clothes. So basically, like, you know, if she was a, well, we don't say that word anymore, but yeah.
We know what you mean.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
But as a result, she sued him for harassment.
Yes!
This is in the 1850s. Like,
dang.
What happened in the in the intervening years? Like, I mean, I know the Victorians happened, but like...
Right. I just want to know, how do you just go up to someone and ask them that?
Yeah, that's messed up, yeah. Even if you do know them. I guess that's why she won.
Yeah. No, apparently this was not the first or last time that she sued somebody over that kind of crap.
Good.
It's interesting. Most historical characters who are known to cross-dress, there's always this question of, were they cross-dressing or were they trans and just didn't have a word for it? But it's like, we seem to know with her. She made her opinions known about the matter, it seems.
Yeah, right. And of course, it's, you know, it's very difficult to actually, like, ask because she's dead. But I think that, you know, regardless of what her actual experience was, I think it's very... I still feel like she is like, I don't know, she's like a little historical torch of just, you know, fuck around and find out. I know it's not like
yes,
but yeah. you know, regardless of how we interpret her, I feel like she's very inspirational either way.
Yeah.
So you said she died at 86 and she was a foreman for 40 years. Was she still going out on boats at 86?
I don't believe so.
Because you said she became a foreman when she was 26, so...
Yes. So, sometime in her 60s, or her... Yeah, like, end of her 60s, she stopped being a foreman and didn't go fishing as much. Apparently, she was still quite active. I mean, she was still shepherding when she was 77. Like,
wild.
Which, to be honest, that's just what farmers are like, in my experience. Mm.
Yeah,
but there's also one Yeah, there's one piece of info where there was this famous travel writer who came to Iceland. Actually, she is a whole story of her own. She came here because her fiancé had gone missing and probably drowned in a lake in an active volcano.
Okay!
I mean,
there were so many things.
The volcano was not currently bubbling, you know, it was a whole thing. But she came here to search for him, and she hired Thuridur as her guide for a part of the trip. And at this point, like, Thuridur was in her late 70s.
Oh my gosh.
And she, like, describes her as this, like, kind of just incredibly arresting figure who went on foot in the rain and in the just terrible weather most of the trail without resting while this woman was on horseback, and she was just like, I wish it was anywhere else, but I gotta finish this.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So, you know, she was apparently still getting up to some stuff quite into her old age.
To be as tough as this woman.
For real.
The amazing thing is that I actually ran into quite a few ladies like her when researching this topic. And many of them, you know, if their stories were written down, it was mostly their own diaries or their own letters.
Mm-hmm.
But because they never did anything quote-unquote extraordinary, even though they practically speaking did extraordinary things every day, nobody, you know, wrote books about them. But yeah, that's the story of Formann Þuríður Einarsdóttir, my favorite
I love her.
Historical lady.
I love her so much.
Me too.
Wow.
Is there like, I don't know, what's something that you found out about her that was really surprising to you? I mean, like, the whole story is kind of amazing, but is there anything that stuck out like, no?
Yeah, so actually the part where her involvement in the investigation was directly a result of her wanting the papers to be able to continue cross-dressing, that is not included in most other sources I've like read until I went to the original source. It was just like, oh, and also she sold the case, like, it was just, you know, dropped in there. And
they don't find that detail interesting?
I find it incredibly interesting. Like, I feel like that is something I would have done in her shoes.
Right?
Yeah. Like, I'll get involved in a criminal investigation if it means I get to wear, you know, pants and a top hat in public.
I just...
That's like, can I get a pass on some minor crimes if I have to do this?
I think it's become a theme. We all know that there was just an influx of detective stories for a bit. But there, right. Several people have tried to do the, like, the detective who has to do this because of some reason or whatever.
Right.
And I think this is the most hilarious, just best case that I've ever seen.
I think so. Especially if, you know, you as a storyteller kind of leave the audience hanging for most of the story until the very end, where it's like, oh, what is the deep and personal reason that this person has been following these criminals for, you
yes.
know, months, and it's like, oh, I just don't want to give up pants. that sounds like a Terry Pratchett book. It really does.
I mean, I did a whole series about how they did execute Joan of Arc for wearing pants. So
yeah.
Like,
I was waiting for you to bring up Joan of Arc, Rissa.
Let women wear pants.
Let anybody wear whatever.
But thank you. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you so much, Sebastian. I learned so much today.
Yeah, this is fantastic.
Yeah. So thank you for listening, dear listeners. Thank you to Tristan from Vintage Lab Tech for our music, and to Caitlin Thompson for our graphics and design, and to Sebastian for joining us.
Until next time, learn something worth knowing.